So, my name is Rainer Spurzen. I'm from Heidelberg. Actually, I put up this herald of our institute. This is a state herald of Baden-Württemberg, southwestern Germany. And it is not the Max Planck Institute in Heidelberg. This is why I just put this up, because many people happen to know this. It is the largest institute. We are actually a smaller institute downtown dealing with astrometry and stellar dynamics. Some computing aspects, depending on the discussion, I may have some time at the end to come to this. And I'm here to report, it's more like a progress report, nothing really complete, about a project with Mirek Girsch and Douglas Lin. Who could that guy be? Doug Lin, maybe it sounds less, well, Douglas always reminds us to somebody else. So just I should put Doug here, probably. But you will know whom I mean. And yeah, well, and this is about orbit evolution of planetary systems in stellar clusters. This will be one aspect which influences planetary orbits, and as I said, it's ongoing work, and there will be some things which are maybe not yet wrapped up. And well, we will see this in the discussion.
Why did it look like a fireworks thing?
Well, this is because I took just some of the templates which are given in PowerPoint, and this is the one I found nicest. Actually, I started using that title giving talk in Japan, because I know the Japanese like fireworks and firecrackers. Actually, in Shigeru's institute, I started using that. But you are the first, I think, for a long time to ask why you're taking this. But I didn't bother to draw this all myself.
That's
this is,
good.
Certainly it means there's a firework of ideas, and guess who? Guess who? Or who is it? Yeah. Anyway, let's see not to get trapped in the discussion too early. Now, all this thing is certainly again about the eccentricity of many planets. In this plot here, I have plotted the semi-major axis of extrasolar planets and their eccentricity. So here you see they are all large eccentricities. We have just heard in the talk that we have to wonder also why the terrestrial planets have so extremely small eccentricities. This is another aspect. But here the main starting question is, why also do we get high eccentricities? I will skip this introduction, because some of this talk was aimed to another audience, and I will just go to this slide here, where we have also seen similar plots in the previous talk, where we just see that at the end of oligarchic growth, we have here, as a function of semi-major axis, some eccentricities of bigger bodies which have grown into isolation, and mostly the eccentricity is small, maybe not as small as needed for terrestrial planets, but it is too small for the extrasolar ones. So people have come up with ideas what excites eccentricities of planets. We have heard about this secular instability and sweeping resonances and many things. So there are certainly a lot of processes, but actually we thought and that was somehow due also to my background, actually, in star cluster evolution and stellar dynamics of star clusters, that we want to focus on one less seriously examined effect. And this is how systematically parameters of planetary orbits are affected by the fact that they are embedded in a dense star cluster. So that could be a young massive star cluster or open cluster, but also I'm talking about some simulations which are more applicable to the situation of globular clusters. So this will be all mixed a little bit. It is rather theoretical talk, where I just discuss some basic processes going on. And as I said, so the wrap up, really, the end and the final interpretation, I think, is something we are doing right here now. So I will skip again this. I mean, we have heard a lot about the other processes which are known to change planetary orbit parameters. I'll focus here about the effect of star clusters and stellar encounters with stars. And here is some of the previous work, which also, regarding to time, I just want to go through, don't want to go through it in detail. There are some small N-body simulations, some semi-analytic simulations, which determine cross sections for changes of eccentricities. And all of that is some, if coupled at all with cluster evolution, it is with somewhat strange recipes, and there is a lot to say to these papers, but I really don't want to go much into it. And the only thing I want to show is to set somehow the expectation. Sorry, yeah, I'm just in your line of sight, but probably like that is working. Yeah, good. just to give you an impression or an idea about what time scales we are talking here. So this is just from this semi-analytic simulations, Davies and Sigurdsson. Some time scales in years for systems to be broken up or left in eccentric orbits if they start with circular orbit. So we are talking here about something like 10 to the 8 years, well, in some cases even much more. So this is a very small process. We are not talking about something which suddenly changes eccentricities. We are talking about small changes and want to get an idea how they affect planetary orbits, and that, as I will show you now from our simulation, that effect will show some surprising results. And on the other hand side, there is some analytic work done on this, first on by Heggie and Razio, and now also later on I have a citation of a work by Roy and Haddow, I think, yes. So Heggie Razio did some estimates for eccentricity changes by one just individual small angle encounter with a passing star, and Roy and Haddow did similar things for the energy or semi-major axis changes. So later, when we come to the interpretation of my numerical simulations, we will just compare the results with this is really analytical approach with some approximations. So this is the background, and now I come to two types of numerical experiments. One is more aimed to the open cluster or young massive star cluster environment. This is a direct n-body modeling of a star cluster with a few thousand objects, 5,000 stars, 1,000 planetary systems, some simulation with 20,000 stars also. And here we are using a direct n-body integrator, which actually goes back to Sverre Arset and Sabro Mikula, where the plus plus actually is denoting its highly parallel version, which works on, well, Cray-T3E and also BeowulfPC clusters. So this is some work which has been done in our group and by me personally also to create this massively parallel version. And what I'm showing you, well, I should say, so that the planets are all regularized to their host star. That means we use very efficient methods to treat the perturbed two-body problem in four-dimensional space where the gravitational potential is regular, is a harmonic potential, so this makes a very efficient and very accurate integration, and so we can very nicely and relatively efficiently follow in great detail, in great accuracy, all the orbital changes of the planets in the n-body simulation. When they are perturbed, and it has an encounter, they are perturbed by the passing stars, all this perturbation is self-consistently taken into account here. And we have a rather special setup in order to study the effects going on in a statistical way or in a theoretical way. That is, there's a number of simulations with 5,000 stars. 1,000 of them have a planet attached, assuming 3 to 50 AU range in semi-major axis, and we have different simulations where all the planets have same eccentricity. So we can see how the effects change as a function of the eccentricity. Also, for comparison, there's a run where we have mixed all the eccentricities. This is thermal distribution. So what does one get, basically? It's things like, so I'm showing you some raw data, and we will show you also some interpretations later or cross-sections. Raw data basically look like this, just as an example, where we have here the eccentricity change as a function of the semi-major axis, 3 to 50, and when we monitor in our system what happens, we basically see a kind of noise going on here, very tiny changes all the time, and some events which create larger changes. And actually the colors denote positive and negative changes of eccentricity. And the first thing which is interesting here is that there is really a rough symmetry between positive and negative changes. So what this implies is that there is something like a diffusion going on, which in this fluctuating star cluster background causes the eccentricities to migrate in both ways. And actually,
Isn't it just a phase effect? Sometimes you excite, sometimes you
didn't excite. Yes, it's, I mean, you can, when you look in the Heggie-Razio formula, you can see that you get the changing sign by the sine I, sine omega, and so on terms. Yeah.
So you expect equal numbers of ups and downs.
Yeah, when you look in the Heggie-Razio formula, it's not surprising. That's yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So on that diffusion.
And you're plotting delta E per encounter.
Yes. Yes. Actually, this is.
Rosemary, it is a diffusion process because the encounter from the stars. You know, they're not. They're on parabolic orbits or hyperbolic orbits.
Yeah.
Okay. So there's no.
They are not correlated. The encounters. So therefore the
you're entering with many different
levels. Absolutely, and each delta
is independent from the previous one.
That's why it's
Yeah.
Is this still around the planets?
No. So this is just actually it's just one single planet around every star. So in this kind of n-body codes, one has to be very careful, really, to have more than one planet, because the planet-planet interactions are very difficult to model. One can do this, but for this study, we didn't want to do this and just leave this out. That's actually the interaction of this kind of changes with other things like resonances or gas interaction. That is something on our agenda, I would say.
What is the distribution of delta eccentricity?
Oh my goodness.
You mean the initial distribution is listed there?
No. Actually, due to this uncorrelated nature and the velocity distribution of the stellar system, I would assume it's Gaussian, but I never have really looked at it, I have to say, yes. Yeah. So I can't answer this at this moment. So now we come to another view on this problem. And this is actually, again, we have eccentricity change here. And now we plot the eccentricity change as a function of semi-major axis change. And now what we see there is something, this is for initially eccentric orbits of 0.6. So we see, again, a big cloud here, which seems to be uncorrelated changes in eccentricity and semi-major axis. And we see some tail here with some correlation. So the colors again denote positive, negative. So this all looks like more or less symmetric changes in both directions, what you would call the phase dependent factors. Now the question is how to interpret this. What is going on here? I mean, clearly this thing would be caused by closer encounters, and this would be more distant encounters, or even the wobbling around of the potential in a stellar cluster. Actually, here is the same thing. If we start with nearly circular orbits, what we see then is that the eccentricity change go down, and this slope is a little bit different. So this is in accord with the expectation that for circular orbit, the eccentricity change should be the same order than semi-major axis change, while for the eccentric orbit, it should have one higher order. So now I'm just skipping some cross sections, and also I think due to time, I will just pass by some measurements we did here in this case for escaping planets, some conclusions of free floaters in the cluster, which appear to be higher than in the case of the semi-analytic work, but I want actually to go on to the second numerical method, because that helped us to understand what is going on in the previous thing. So we will just come back to that kind of plot we have seen before. The second method actually is Monte Carlo approach to model a star cluster, a really large star cluster with particle numbers which are impossible to model with direct n-body. This have developed together with Mira Girsch in a series of papers. The paper 3 just appeared this year. It was last autumn or this. I think it was 2003 still, yeah, just appeared, the paper 3. And this actually couples the Monte Carlo method based on the Fokker-Planck approximation to model the self-consistently evolving stellar cluster in the background. And on top of that, we have binaries, which could be planetary system, which could be stellar binaries. And these binaries are interacting in 3 and 4 body interactions with each other or with single field stars. And these interactions are integrated using the high accuracy triple or chain or quad integrators by RZ and Mikola. So whenever we have such encounter, we perform the encounter, and at the end we look at the energetic balance and do the proper interaction with the stellar system. By that, doing such simulations, we will have typically a run of hundreds of thousands of encounters in the course of an evolving globular cluster. So here are some plots how well this Monte Carlo method works. If you are interested in this, I can just say more about it. Here I will just show you one example of the model. And this is just the initial model regarding the planetary systems now. Now we have a study of 300,000 stars with 30,000 planets. And they are initially here arranged in semi-major axis and in E square. And in this space, we have a homogeneous distribution initially. So we cover all eccentricities. This is a thermal eccentricity distribution. And in log A, we have also equal distribution. And now we let this evolve very much in the same way as before in the n-body simulation. And this is the picture after 340 million year, and this is after about 2.6 giga year. And what we get is actually that here after 340 million year, about 80% of the planets have been liberated from the system. I don't have the number now, how many go away from the cluster, how many stay in the cluster.
I was asking, how many planets do you have in each system?
One. Just again,
oh,
same.
That makes a big difference, doesn't it?
Yeah. It may make a difference because this...
It will make a big difference, but it's very difficult.
Yeah.
That's a
simple
problem.
Yeah, yeah.
are your systems with planets, are they the binaries or...
Pardon?
Which ones are
binaries?
Are they binary stars? I'm talking here in this simulation, binaries, when I talk about binaries, I mean the planetary systems. Yeah. So this in these papers with Girsch, we have studied stellar binaries with this method. But what I'm showing here is just without stellar binaries, which would be the next step, which will also be a more complicated problem. But the problem is we want to study here this effect and see its underlying physics. So therefore, we just take out all the other effects which disturb it and may change the result. And as you will see, this is not a talk about free floaters. So, I mean, I'm not.
It's amazing that the fraction of free floaters, given their single planetary systems, they're all scattered out by these individual.
Well, actually. Actually, I will tell you that the rate of free floaters we get is not very different from the one for example, Hurley and Schara get in their simulation. Although I don't trust very much, I mean, they have some planet-planet interactions, but I don't trust their method very much. So,
if you restrict your attention to planets that have small eccentricities initially rather than from a thermal distribution, is that significantly reduced in their free floaters?
I think so, yes, but I think,
well,
can we see it? Yes,
this
is smaller. I mean, you have a lower order in eccentricity change when you start with initially circular orbits. I'm just thinking whether I have some information about that, but not actually, no, I think the effect is probably not very strong, but as we can see here, I mean, I just want to draw your attention here to some, I mean, initially we were somewhere here at 3IU, and we get systems here which get very close to 1AU, which go in, but we get them basically at all eccentricities. Yeah? Now, what you are doing with that when there are planet-planet interactions, I mean, that is something interesting possibly going on. But just this process alone gives you highly eccentric planets very close.
Can you
Hi Fred, yeah. This is 2.6 giga years and this is 340 million years.
Okay, well you get it 100 times.
Well this is not a Hubble time, but this is something like evolutionary time of a globular cluster, 2.6. I mean,
well what would you get at 13 giga years? I mean, are there any left?
In this there are not many left actually, but I think there are many things which for a real cluster one has to take into account in such a simulation to really, I think.
In some sense, it's the upper limit of what is left, right? If you put in any other thing, like multiple planets and all that.
I would say it depends. When you look at star cluster evolution, it's more like a lower limit because it's a single mass system. It has no tidal field, it has no binaries, and all these effects will increase the activity of this process.
Well,
on the other hand side,
I'm just saying the upper limit of what is left.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Lower
yes.
Limit.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
On the
yes.
Other hand, yes. We have pairs of planets, and we have interactive. Right.
No, but you can't go very much right in because it's already about you know, and then the tidal effect when you combine that will really drag in.
So I think I will come back now to this scattering plots and to try to shed some light on what is going on really. When we look in this space again, where we have here the eccentricity change and the semi-major axis change, and we again see now here in the simulation, like in the n-body calculations I showed you earlier, some kind of correlated change here going into a bigger cloud with seemingly uncorrelated changes of eccentricity and energy. However, when we look actually at the prediction of the Hegyi-Razi formula plus the Roy and Hedo paper, which we both need, then we would get something which is more closer to that line here, to the red points. So these points, the green and blue ones, so in this case, it's just the whole lower thing, seem to disagree actually with the semi-analytic models. And the clue to understand that actually is just the nature of the encounter, and that is what we were able only to find out in the Monte Carlo system, because only in the Monte Carlo system we have really nice, really uncorrelated encounters. In the n-body system, I was a little bit cheating when we say the encounters are uncorrelated, this is what we assume in the first place. But actually, when you go down to very tiny changes, this assumption is not very good anymore. So we get a background of scattering, and it is difficult to disentangle a posteriori after simulation each individual encounter with its parameters. So the Monte Carlo code here is a very good tool to see what's going on actually. We see here the real effect of scatterings, and the E prime is actually the degree of the amount of velocity at infinity. So E primes to be a small number, E prime 1 is a parabolic encounter, and E prime small number means the red points, these are the parabolic encounters, and the green and blue ones are encounters which are moderately or highly hyperbolic, so with a high velocity. Yes. Well, actually, it's not that much the distance which matters here, so we will see.
It's the energy, but the thing is that if they all have a similar velocity, if there's some velocity distance.
Now this is a two-dimensional.
Electricity comes from how it depends on
the distance. This is a two-dimensional space. This is actually not only the distance, as you can see here, where we have where again we have now here the energy change as a function of basically the pericenter distance normalized by the semi-major axis. And here you can see again the red points, which is the Roy and Hedro curve, exponential decay here, which very well agrees with the parabolic encounter. However, for the high velocity encounters, we have here just points going away from that. And that actually, I think, is the reason why most of the semi-analytic approaches deliver not the correct diffusion times and changing times for the eccentricities in semi-major axis. So you have really two parameters here determining the result. Actually, this is a more simpler problem as we discussed, because these are things which are highly impulsive, you know. You don't have probably to take into account orbit averaging and things like that for these encounters. But they provide a higher energy change. They don't follow this exponential decay here. So we have higher impact on the orbits.
Right, yeah. Maybe I used it at the beginning, I walked in the middle. For things, any kind of binary with extremely unequal mass ratio, there's always been this question of what defines really a hard binary versus a soft binary. Did you talk about this at the beginning?
No, because...
And the question is the right quantity to look at the energy, the binding energy, or the order of speed? There are a few early papers by Hills claiming that really the right thing to look at is the ratio of order of speed to velocity dispersion of the background, as opposed to ratio of energy, which makes sense if you think of going into the Hess particle limit where it should become independent of the mass of the companion. Have you looked at this?
Yes, the one point is, I mean, you are right, it doesn't make sense for these systems where the secondary mass is very small. It doesn't make sense. There is nothing like a hard binary threshold of 3 kT or so. The next thing to look at would be the squared velocity, so the energy per mass. But still there is no threshold in the sense that you could say there exists a threshold for wider binaries, they are widened, or for harder binaries, they are hardened. That doesn't seem to exist. So you always have a diffusion, and only at the very outer end, really, for the very loosely bound and highly eccentric system, there's a slight asymmetry in the cross section. I skipped the cross sections here. When you look at the cross section, well, no, cross section is coming, sorry. Think.
That
yeah.
Has implications for accuracy of integrations, too. People are concerned about degrees.
Yeah, actually here we see the differential cross section as a function of the change of energy, and the points are the numerical simulations. This one for positive changes and this one for this negative change and positive change, here you see that the points are slightly higher, so the cross section is higher for widening the planet, and it is a bit smaller for tightening. And this effect is here just for the strong encounters you can see it, but for most of the encounters it's very symmetric. Yeah. And the same is actually for eccentricity, it's even more symmetric. The lines here, I mean the red line is the Hegge and Razio cross section, this one. And here we have actually, the red line is what Roy and Hedo would predict, and there we see this deviation, which comes from the hyperbolic encounters. So here we have asymmetry. Yes. This here is about the 10%. Well, this is not the orbit. I mean, this is not in terms. I should put this in several bins for different orbital speeds. I didn't do this. I don't think there is evidence that there is a strong dependence on orbital speed. One can't really see it from this figure, because this takes together all orbital speeds and just distinguishes the different changes.
I guess I'm just surprised that you have such a difference for a cluster. The dispersion is smaller than the rotation speed planet that's QAU. So I would have expected for these close encounters that they were all parabolic or nearly parabolic.
Well,
so
it
I'm kind of surprised.
Well, it depends on our P actually. So these are all encounters which have a very large pericenter distance yet. So there is some.
It's
called fusing, but it you fix the velocity and the eccentricity goes up. Anyway. So this is an outlook, because it's not only eccentricity and semi-major axis which is changed. It's also other orbital parameters, and here is just some raw data for the inclination change, for example, inclination change and eccentricity change, so we get similar things, which also one could compare with the semi-analytic models. I didn't do this yet, this is just the raw data, but this is something different from many of the other processes, so that we are changing also the orbital orientation of the planets. And I think, some question? I think I will skip some sections here about the systems which we do the simulations. This is on part of the N-body simulations, either the GRAPE systems here, Jun Makino, and also on our PC cluster here at home with a BeoWulf cluster, which also competes with the supercomputers for this N-body applications. And I will just jump to the conclusions. I think I have said already, so I will just stop here. Thanks for your attention.
So what's the work to understand?
Your formula doesn't work.
Well, it's just it would be nice to have some generalization of the semi-analytic theory for this more hyperbolic encounters.
And actually, we do the hyperbolic case, and then we specialize at the end to parabolic. Just in that limit, all the results are there for fully hyperbolic encounters.
I'm a little bit. I'm a bit stunned because I talk with this about Douglas, and he thought there might be some terms missing, and actually.
It's very nice to establish that globular clusters have disrupted planetary systems, but I kind of wonder what they are with star in the field, with relevance.
I think,
they have been born in clusters, but not globular clusters. And the question is, how does that cluster environment that the stars in the field, which are now being surveyed for planets, how are they affected by the cluster environment? And so I'm curious as to what you think about that more
triple. Well, I think there's a long step in between, and it is. I was a bit suggestive to put in the beginning the extrasolar planetary systems of today. I mean, this is certainly a phase. This is two things. This is a phase where planetary systems are influenced, or even planetesimal disks with protoplanets are influenced in their area where they are born, in the case of young star clusters, young massive or open star clusters. And the other thing is the globular cluster problem. I mean, for the globular cluster problem, we have planetary systems which stay there. I mean, the planets and their host stars stay there all the time. So this is a two ways, I think, to use that results over two scenarios where this could be interesting. I mean, one is about planetary systems in globular clusters, and the other is about forming planetary systems or young systems in open clusters.
Right. Also, this question of free floaters in the context, these small body circuits, they're essentially very insensitive mass. You know, in the context of brown dwarfs, free floaters is also relevant. And finally, it's relevant in the context of perhaps relevant in the context of why the Kuiper Belt object had a bubble. Because instead of having these close encounters, you may have distant encounters, and then circularization from the gas the residual gas will then cause orbital decay. These are the various potential implications. But we know all stars are formed in clusters.
Isn't there a paper on SOPH today by Alice Quillen?
Doesn't invoke that particular scenario at all.
I just want to say something to Fred. I mean, the point is that the results which you get with Heggy are just the results which we find for the parabolic encounters, where parabolic means we go with E prime maybe up to 2, so it could be slightly hyperbolic. But when we go to higher velocities, the results deviate from what your paper predicts. That's the point.
What results are you talking about? I mean, our paper just calculated change.
Yeah, I know what your paper is calculated, but
just.
I mean, there's obviously more to it than just understanding change in eccentricity on the same major axis in a single encounter. I mean, you've got to put it in the whole.
Actually, I think I should put it another way, because usually I put the reason Roy and Haddow paper and your paper somehow together, and we used Monte Carlo then to see what it would predict. And this actually is where the strongest discrepancy is to the Roy and Haddow paper. So there is the exponential decay in the energy change, and this is clearly not found in the.
So what is that line? Yeah. That line is the parabolic result, then.
No, this is also not, it is not strictly limited to parabolic encounters. It's the equivalent to your work with Heggy for energy changes, for semi-major axis changes. And here is where Douglas said, okay, he will look whether there are some terms missing. Now, when we look in the eccentricity changes, I should rescue you in that sense. When we look in the eccentricity changes, the effect is much less strong. You could say it all fits, although after we have seen this clear effect in the semi-major axis, where we see it's clearly wrong, I would say also here is a strong tendency that only the small e prime tend to be in very good agreement with the prediction. So this is the predicted cross-section from Heggy and Razio paper now. And here these points here go down. So here we have actually smaller changes. We have smaller changes in eccentricity and larger changes in energy as compared to the combined semi-analytic predictions of your paper and Roy and Haddow. So this is the result.
Yeah,
so
this is sense. Can I make a small comment? I don't know if this has been discussed already, but I just came back from this conference in Aspen we had last week on pulsars. And this is relevant to the question of planets in global clusters. You remember there's been this very interesting system, 16:20-26 in the global cluster M4, which for about 10 years now we suspected had a planet in a very wide orbit around this inner binary pulsar. And the only thing that had not yet been confirmed is that the mass of this outer companion really makes it a planet. The latest timing data for the pulsar, which were announced last week, now make the mass of the outer companion just about exactly one Jupiter mass. That's a new result, and that's, you know, for the people who follow the story and kept, you know, wondering whether this thing really is a planet or maybe just a brown dwarf. I think, you know, just by mass, I mean, the usual, you know, way of thinking, if the mass is sufficiently low, you call it a planet. This is definitely a planet.
Right, what's the mass of inclination then?
The system is, I mean, there's still some significant error bars on the secular perturbations. That's what gives you the three-dimensional geometry. But there's no, I mean, the error bar on the fifth pulse frequency derivative, which is the one that gives you the full orbit, and the mass, is now, you know, small enough that, you know, it cannot be more than 1.5 or 2 Jupiter.
But I'm asking if they know the relative inclination of the two orbits.
Yeah, that's what you can determine from the secular perturbations in the system. And those, I think the error bars have shrunk also, but the observers haven't quite done the analysis yet.
Okay.
So there's almost independent white dwarf results from last summer.
Yeah, that's true. So the yeah, that's an old result. There was an HST detection of the inner one dwarf companion, which gave nicely the age of the system. It's about half a giga-year old, which is comforting because it can't survive much longer than that in the Western environment. So it's a nice self-consistency check. Anyway, so there are planets and clusters. And more than that, there are planets and clusters that are still in down orbits.
Well, I wouldn't contradict that. I mean, the question is of the frequency, yeah. And that, yeah, that is, yeah, also the question of the history.
Yeah. My code says it's true, and I don't care what nature says.
It doesn't say that there are planets still in bound orbit, in their original bound orbit.
Wasn't there a theory that this is a result of a recent encounter, something like that?
I mean, it's just,
with a binary, something like that, yeah.
It's in the highlights, yeah.